very few people these days die what you would call a natural death anymore. Death used to be relatively swift from infectious diseases and cancers that came swiftly and relatively mercifully. These days, most illnesses are gradually progressive and sometimes enter an extremely long, a prolonged dying stage. We prevent, for example, the death of people with profound dementia by treating what would have caused their natural death in days gone by. Every infection, every failure of an organ system, etc. So there are many, many people who have something that they can and would want to stop, or some medical treatment they would want to decline in certain circumstances. Compassion and Choices urges people to think about those things and think about the circumstances in which they would not want to submit to a prolonged and torturous dying process from a terminal illness or prolonged dementia.
Are there examples in the other states' jurisdictions that you have alluded to that you would point to say that this is something that Illinois should do?
Well, Illinois might look to its fairly proximate neighbor, Minnesota, that has begun to have serious conversations about legislation on medical aid in dying. Just last week, I was in Minneapolis for an informational hearing on a medical aid in dying bill that has been introduced in the Minnesota legislature. So that's just another example of a legislative initiative being a kind of a long-term project with many steps. And even when the conversation moves to the legislature, often it begins with preliminary conversations with potential sponsors and then perhaps moves to informational hearings to inform other legislators. And it may be a number of years before there's a bill that's actually moving through the legislature. So people in Illinois who are interested in this and how the sequence of events happens might look to Minnesota as an example and follow that course.
Has your organization received pushback from religious organizations about this?
Well, certainly. Every time there is a bill considered in the legislature, and any time there is a bill before the citizens on the ballot, for example, as it was in Oregon and Washington and Colorado, the chief opposition comes from the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, the Conference of Catholic Bishops and the local diocese. They believe that these laws contravene Catholic doctrine, and so they oppose them on that basis.
Is there any expectation that such a proposal could become reality in Illinois?
Oh, yes. I have the expectation that ultimately medical aid in dying will be a reality with the majority of states. Right now, with those 10 jurisdictions, over 20% of Americans live in a jurisdiction where they have the option to access medical aid in dying. I have no doubt that at some point, Illinois will join those jurisdictions. It would be difficult to predict when that might be.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Barbara Combs Lee, president of Compassion and Choices, and she's the author of Finish Strong, Putting Your Priorities First at Life's End. She's speaking at Illinois State University's Alumni Center on October the 7th, and she'll be speaking more broadly about end-of-life decisions and how to prepare your family for them. Is there an age that you recommend that someone should have this in place for themselves and their family?
You know, it's never too early to talk about what you would want if the time came when you could not speak for yourself and you were permanently unconscious or terminally ill. It's important to remember that, you know, the seminal case law about end-of-life decisions came from very young people. Karen Ann Quinlan was in her early 20s. Terry Schiavo was in her late 20s. Nancy Cruzan was very young as well. All those three women helped shape the law around end-of-life decisions because they and their loved ones found themselves in situations where there was doubt about what a person would want, how much life-sustaining, life-prolonging treatment they would want if they were suddenly in the situation in which they actually did find themselves.
How far does it get you to have relayed to loved ones, family, friends, a partner, what you would like to have done in that circumstance, but it's not in writing?
It will get you only so far as people's memory serves them well, and the memories of all those people whom you spoke to corroborate each other. So if you said one thing to one person and one thing to another, different thing to another person, then there will be controversy. And then, of course, sometimes what we say to other people is pretty vague and not specific enough to be clear. So that's another reason to document these things and to be very specific. You know, if I am unconscious, if I cannot read, if I cannot recognize my loved ones, if I have to be fed with a tube, if I have to be spoon-fed, you know, all those kinds of very concrete markers of the degree of consciousness, the degree of participation in daily life. It's very good to be specific.
You brought up several examples where this planning came into play for people much younger than many people start to think about these sorts of things. Has that changed the trend? Did that encourage more people to start this sort of life planning and end-of-life planning sooner?
I think it did, although the statistics are that most people who actually fill out advance directive forms and record them in their healthcare record are probably 65 years of age or older. I think one example in sort of popular media that did elevate these issues to visibility, and not only about unconsciousness, but about contemporaneous end-of-life decisions when people can still speak for themselves, was the case of Brittany Menard, who in 2014, at the age of 29, Brittany developed a brain tumor, a lethal brain tumor, a glioblastoma. And as she underwent treatment that was unsuccessful, as she assessed her options, about how to access care and what kind of options for a peaceful death she might have. She's the person who moved from California to Oregon in order to avail herself of the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. She decided that it was bad enough that her cancer was going to take her life. She did not want to have to suffer unbearably in the process. So she moved to Oregon, and she became eligible for medical aid in dying after she obtained medication that she could take in order to die peacefully in her sleep. She made a public pronouncement about that, and there was a stories in People magazine and later picked up by many, many mainstream media. So Brittany Menard became the face of medical aid in dying. And I think one reason her story was so compelling and she was so compelling because of her youth, because she was only 29 years old, because she was such a self-possessed, clear thinker, because she took such care in her plans, and because of the choice that she made to move from California to Oregon and to die peacefully of her own volition with medical aid in dying.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Barbara Combs Lee, president of Compassion and Choices, the author of Finish Strong, Putting Your Priorities First at Life's End. She will be speaking at Illinois State University's Alumni Center on Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. What are the common mistakes that people make in this discussion? Is it simply assuming that there will always be a tomorrow?
Well, yes, we always assume that there will be a tomorrow. I think there's also a kind of an unconscious assumption that if we think about these things, if we talk about these things, somehow that's flirting with fate and inviting death, or somehow would be morbid. My experience, the experience of my colleagues, is exactly the opposite, is that facing our mortality and living with an understanding that we are mortal beings is very life-enhancing. It raises the consciousness of the preciousness of every minute of every day of our lives. So I think that it is not at all morbid. It's actually life-enhancing for us to think about our mortality and confront it directly and make plans for how we would want the last chapter of our life to be written.
I would like to know at what point in your own personal journey that you decided to start putting this together for yourself to prepare for your life's end, and if there's any personal anecdotes or personal experiences from family, et cetera, that may have steered you in this direction to think about this maybe sooner than you would have.
I began my career as a candy striper in high school. I grew up in Illinois, and I was a candy striper at St. Joseph's Hospital in Joliet, Illinois. After that, I went to college, then to nursing school. I practiced in many acute care settings, ICUs and emergency rooms, for many years before I then went into medicine and practiced cardiology. So I witnessed many deaths, and certainly some of them made a profound impression on me. It was profoundly impactful to be with people as they struggled with their deaths and fought against it and never did seem to come to a place of acceptance, had miserable deaths, and then compare those with people who seemed to go very gently into an environment of love and grace, if you will, their death experience was enveloped in that. The difference between those two, I decided pretty early on, was not so much a difference in how those people died, but how those people lived. So if I made any kind of an early resolution, it was to live as full and authentic and whole a life, as loving as I possibly could. And in that way, have a full life that then, when it came to its end, was not filled with resentment and regret.